Our moderator, she does apologize, but she had a health problem, one of her relatives, and she asked me to present. Will you please, those of you who require English translation, please raise your hands in order to know how many people will hear in Spanish. Well, we have a group, and the rest will be listening in Spanish. Well, of course, the speakers can present either in English or Spanish because we are having simultaneous interpretation. And I'd like to make a very quick intervention. Good nutrition is one of the cornerstones of public health. And both all these deficiencies that we have during pregnancy and excesses, for instance, when eating, are very important factors to attain good health during life. And the point that nutrition is present in this global health meeting speaks about having common problems, common regions, and their solutions can really be benefited by public common goods. And of course, it is very important to have this nutrition topic present. Think that we as researchers can really create regional or international goods in order to fight against this nutrition problem or obesity. And now I will present the first speaker, Dr. Richard Deckenbaum from Columbia University, who will integrate nutrition and health with some other sectors. Dr. Deckenbaum, I will switch into English.
Dirige el Instituto de Nutrición Humana en la Universidad de Columbia, donde tiene un título como pediatra y epidemiólogo, además de la investigación básica que ha hecho sobre lípidos y nutrición humana, ha traducido realmente la ciencia a aplicaciones prácticas en distintas publicaciones, en distintas poblaciones. Durante muchas ocasiones ha fungido como parte del comité consultor y también en la Academia
Columbia side of the Medical School for International Health, a novel medical school for training global health practitioners at Ben Gurion University of the Negev in Israel, in collaboration with Columbia University Medical Center. Currently, he continues in projects related to health and science, bridging different populations in the Middle East, Africa, Asia, and serves as president of the Global Health Education Consortium. We are very pleased and honored to have Dr. Richard Deckenbaum with us in this presentation.
Thank you very much, Juan, and it's really, in addition to being up here a couple of times during this meeting, it's really a distinct pleasure, and I want to thank the organizers, at INSP for creating a terrific intellectual program here, which I'm very, very pleased to be able to contribute to. It's my first visit to Cuernavaca, and it's a very exciting place to be. And I'm going to be talking today about integrating nutrition and health with other sectors. So that we've heard a number of definitions and a number of approaches during our meeting here in the last 3 days about defining global health, and I'm not going to repeat the definitions. I'm just going to paraphrase from a slide that Dr. Hali Dabbas made at a Bellagio conference we had recently, to stress that in terms of global health, that we really need greater interdisciplinary connections with other sectors, especially with the non-health sciences. And what I'd like to point out today is how we have to do this with nutrition and health, just like the other sectors that are going to be important in global health. So if we now are facing worldwide a new paradigm, if you will, in human nutrition, and that's, at least in English, called the double burden, that we have coexisting, and we'll see some of this, the problems of under and malnutrition, but we have another kind of malnutrition emerging, and that's overnutrition with the obesity overweight epidemic. And I just must say that I've seen presentations of Dr. Rivera in the past on the state of the state of overnutrition in Mexico, which is here a very, very serious problem. So this double burden exists here in Mexico. So if we think of global health and nutrition, we have to put it in a framework of interacting dimensions. So at the core here, we have global health and nutrition. We have medical aspects, non-medical aspects, and social aspects. This is too simple, but let's just start with this type of triangle. So we'll start with the medical aspects of nutrition and health. Oops. And this is the people who were trained in nutrition 40 years ago, and especially in what was then international health. This is a picture, of course, of kwashiorkor. So malnutrition, underweight, undernutrition was the classic picture of what nutrition meant in the international South developing country setting. But now, this is a perfect slide to show what we mean by the double burden. And this shows overweight and obesity in preschool children in 94 countries, in which, and I don't expect you to read the names of the countries, but these are mainly developing or southern countries where, on your left here, we look at the prevalence of wasting. So this is severe underweight in children in 94 countries. And on the right side, we see overweight and obesity coexisting with underweight in many countries. These red dots here are the prevalence of overweight and obesity in preschool children in the USA. The yellow dots highlight overweight and obesity in many developing countries. Here's Egypt, by the way, as an example, which have higher prevalence rates than the United States. Mexico probably is here, and I don't know if I've highlighted it. I should have looked at it before, but I would believe that Mexico is it higher, Juan? It's higher. Okay, I just can't see it from here. So these are overweight kids in the southern countries who are going to track to be adults with overweight and obesity. So this is going to have a major implications, and it already is having a major implications, I know, in this country on the healthcare system, healthcare costs. What's an example? I'm only going to show one of a non-medical aspect that has to interact with Global Health and Nutrition. And access to clean water, access to water that is free of pathogens so that you can absorb the nutrients, and essentially having water for sanitation, hand washing, many of the things that we take for granted every day in our everyday life. This is from a village in Kenya where people have to walk about 2 kilometers to bring these pails of water. It happens to be clean, but it takes a 2-kilometer walk. What are some of the social aspects, and I've defined this very, or you can define it very broadly, relating to global health and nutrition? Well, there's enough calories in the world right now for every man, woman, and child. But yet we have underweight, we have malnutrition, and if we look at, this is from the Standing Committee on Nutrition of the United Nations report, if we look at the contribution of different factors to underweight in children in Southeast Asia and Africa, no, this is not a mistake. It's not food availability that's the major problem. Food availability can only explain 1/4 of undernutrition. And look what takes up 50% of a major contribution to underweight. It's women's status and women's education. So we've got to think of empowering women, gender equality, and bringing in women's education to attacking a major problem, which is right now still increasing in sub-Saharan Africa. And this is a survey done from a recent master's student at our institute, compiling data on bringing education into nutrition intervention programs and looking at outcomes, positive outcomes, in terms of either food intake, anthropometric data, lab data, morbidity, mortality. So this is a large number of studies. These are programs that don't include education, and these are programs that include education, mainly of women, as part of the intervention. Well, it's quite striking how different the two groups are. Education makes a big difference, and it's not that expensive to do compared to organizing the whole program. If you don't do it, the program may fail. So what are the costs of doing nothing? Because this is what's happening in many places. So on this slide from the FAO, we're looking at the daily dietary energy supply per capita. And on the y-axis, the gross domestic product per capita in many countries. I'm really astounded by how close this relationship is. Now, what came first, the chicken or the egg, we don't know. But clearly, this is macro calorie intake, if you will, relates to economic productivity in many countries. The FAO also wrote in 2000 that there's evidence that 46 million years of productive disability-free life were lost in 1990, the result of lost social productivity, caused by 4 types of malnutrition: stunting, disorders relating to iodine, iron deficiency anemia, and vitamin A deficiency. Not just blindness, but subclinical vitamin A deficiency, which contributes to much higher mortality and morbidity from infectious diseases. And here's the benefit-cost ratios for nutrition programs. And these are just a few illustrations from a World Bank report, actually that came out in 2006. So these are dollar benefits per cost of the program. And it doesn't take, it's not rocket science to see that the benefit-cost ratios are astounding. Not just in terms of human outcomes, but in terms of economic outcomes. So, for example, if we look here at iron fortification, up to $200 of yield, profit, if you will, for every dollar invested. But also, when you look at this list, think about what are the other sectors that have to be involved besides, let's say, a pure nutritionist. So for fortification programs, let's say with iodine or iron, you've got to have industry involved. You've got to have the people that are handling the salt. You have to have laboratories to be able to do the monitoring that you're actually putting what you say in. You've got to have people who understand bioavailability in, and you've got to have policymakers ensure that this is actually going to happen. What about the cost now, the other side of the double burden, of overnutrition? I'm going to show one thing in cost, and that's human mortality in people who are 35 to 64 years old. Their deaths from cardiovascular disease. So these are people who are in the productive years of life, holding positions in universities, industry, companies, wherever, and they're dying at much higher rates. This is the mortality for USA and in males and females in that age group. But in these countries that are either developing or in transition, the burden of cardiovascular disease is appearing at a much younger age. In the United States and Europe, it's over 65. In these countries, and I'm sure Mexico shares this, we're seeing a much bigger share in this productive age working, this age group. So that if we look here at South Africa, India, and Brazil, 1.5 to 2-fold higher prevalence rates of cardiovascular disease mortality in a productive working group. And in India, for example, a middle-class family, the greatest risk factor for a middle-class family going into poverty is the death of one of the parents, male or female, from cardiovascular disease. Now, what's happening in different countries? And I'm just going to give you one example. So this is Burundi. I was in Burundi in the beginning of January. While I was there, two people, one the head of the facilities and another person, died acutely in their early 50s from a heart attack. Productive years in Burundi, which has got some of the worst health statistics in the world. And what are they doing here in Burundi? They're making palm oil. This oil is dripping here, and it's being collected just down here in a pail, is palm oil, which is very rich in saturated fat. It's becoming, and it's increasingly available. And even though it's a poor country, certain sectors of the population are now having higher rates of heart disease, which leads to not just death, but morbidity. So this suggests that in some countries, and I thank Steve Rumsey from Bungie, who's sitting right there, for providing these slides, we've got to be thinking not just in United States, not just in Mexico, but in countries even that are way below the norms that we think about, of in advance forming public-private partnerships where we want to prevent, this is sort of a good thing in a developing country, let's say lots of palm oil, but it's going to have very, very bad effects on health and health costs. So we've got to be thinking in advance and preparing for lowering, even in developing countries, saturated fat, trans fat, and the sort of bad fats. And we have to be thinking in terms of getting these countries on board as well in terms of improving their intake of good fats, which are the omega-6 polyunsaturated fats, the omega-3 fats, etc. So I would suggest that we don't want to react after the epidemic is developing, but we want to react preventively in advance. And we want to think in terms of sort of the vicious cycles that lead to undernutrition. And this is just one example here where we have the vicious cycle of agriculture, poor management, loss of nutrients, environmental degradation, malnutrition and illness, which spins back into decreasing productivity. And a number of us at the International Union of Nutrition Sciences have been working on this concept of bringing different sectors together in something that we call eco-nutrition, which combines with human nutrition, ecological and environmental control, agriculture, economic development, human behavior, and other factors towards improving human health. And another example, I think, that was we plan programs. We don't want to do one intervention at a time. We want to, because then they'll sequentially fail. What we need is concomitant intersectoral interventions, as exemplified in the Millennium Village Project here in Africa, where we can see that when the projects are started, water, agriculture, human health, business, etc., are actually programmatically developed by the stakeholders, by the villagers and different village committees to make concomitant changes. And if we look at potential solutions to the obesity epidemic, we can see that both its treatment, but especially its prevention, are going to require intersectoral approaches. From individual approaches, where we have to think about drugs, prevention, community approaches, food vending, exercise opportunities. Industry must be involved in terms of what they're producing, portion sizes, and marketing. And governments need to be involved in terms of education, guidelines, and policy. And yes, I would suggest even legislation. But this has got to be done together with integration with the different sectors. So that I would suggest now that we need to think in interdisciplinary ways when we design programs to solve the double burden, and that the solution to these problems of both undernutrition and overnutrition demands intersectoral interventions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Richard, for providing a brilliant global and macro overview of the nutrition problem and its implications. You also provided a very good framework for the following presentations. I will be presenting a country experience, the experience in Mexico, in the development of nutrition policies, how we have what have been the impacts of these policies, and I am going to restrict my presentation just to undernutrition, although we also have been working in overnutrition. I will present in Spanish, so please, for English speakers, can you please turn the translation machine on? Hablaré entonces sobre las políticas de nutrición en México y los efectos de las últimas dos décadas. Perdón, dado que no está la doctora. Nutrición profesor visitante de la Escuela de Salud Pública Robles de Emory, Atlanta, y de la Comisión de Educación de la Universidad de Cornell en Nueva York. Voy a presentarles muy brevemente cuál ha sido la evolución de la desnutrición en México en las últimas casi dos décadas por estudios realizados por nuestro instituto. Nosotros hemos realizado tres encuestas nacionales de nutrición. Entre la primera y la segunda transcurrieron 11 años, entre la segunda y la tercera 17 años. De modo que voy a presentar la evolución, pero expresada en términos de puntos porcentuales por año, para estar por esta diferencia en tiempo. Pido disculpas porque aquí los
To apologize because we are having some problems with the captions, but here we have the prevalence for low weight. The second one is the chronic one. The third one has to do with size, and the fourth one is obesity. And this is just for children under five. I will speak about this as to malnutrition with low weight, and this has been the most important problem here in Mexico. And we see that in the first period between 88 and 99, we had a decrease of 1 percentage point, whereas in the second year, we had a decrease of about 19.9 points per year. When we compare ourselves with this low height in Latin America, we see that Mexico had an inappropriate development, whereas we had a good one during the second period. What happened in the first period, where we were not successful, and what happened in the second one? Well, this is part of what we will discuss later. But let me tell you something. This did not mean that we did not have little between 1988 and 1999. Mexico spent about $2 per day on nutrition, which is really a higher figure than the one recommended by the World Bank. But here we have the evaluation of our performance, or performance evaluation. Between 1988 and 1999, when we see that we have the growth deciles, we see the important difference we have between the poorest and the richest, which is 10 times higher in 1988. Would have expected to have a very sharp decrease due to this very high prevalence, but in the most poor case, in the poorest case, we saw that there is a decile of 0.49, whereas in the next one we see 2.9, and this is really impressive. So we have been able to see these results not in very many places. Now, when we see the average in Mexico, we see that the performance here was totally inappropriate, whereas in the second period, the performance was three times more. The Indian population is the poorest in Mexico, and in the first period, our performance was very poor. 4.53 percentile points in the second period, the performance improved a lot. And in this chart and in the previous one, we need to say that we still have a long way to go to have 34% prevalence in the Indian population, when in the non-Indian is only of 13.2. Well, speaks of a terrible inequality we should not allow. We see here some of the causes, some of the reasons. registered in Mexico City. But when we saw how these $2 were distributed, well, just 15% went to the south, whereas $2 went to Mexico City. This is a window of opportunity to prevent malnutrition. For every 100 kilocalories children get in the first year, they will be growing 1 centimeter, and next year, 0.5. This was published in 1995, and this is the cross-sectional analysis made. However, we need to see that it is very important to really feed properly children, because resources were used after 3 years of age, and it was not correct. This is also a chart of a study we published in 2001, where we showcased that if we include micronutrients, the height will be improved. This is a group that was just getting micronutrients in a syrup form, and the one that was given more nutrients grew by 1.14%, and 1988 Mexico's programs were not a good source of micronutrients. In short, the reasons as to why these programs were not effective are as follows. Well, it was inefficient. The focus was inefficient, and more stress was placed on urban areas. And this was just distributed after children were 2 or 3 years of old. Of course, the food that was distributed was inappropriate for children, and we did not have appropriate micronutrient sources. The education was weak, and programs were not well supplemented. In 1995, the federal government, started the design of the Progresa program. At present, is Oportunidades program, aimed at trying not to have this intragenerational transmission of poverty, so that incentives could be given, so that good investments could be made as to developing human capital, because there were families living under extreme poverty. Well, this Oportunidades program is as follows. There are co-responsible transferences and also money given to the mothers in order to support the food the children are given. Here we include fortified food. For instance, we have NutriSano, Nutri Healthy. It is a formula, and NutriVida, which is given to pregnant and breastfeeding mothers. The other one is a puree. This program had several changes as to the programs in Mexico. And the first thing is that the focus was changed. And now the programs go to poor families, before just to rural zones, but now to very many. Now we see that all this food, which is sure to complement the nutrients they have to have and are enriched, and they are specially designed for children under 2 years of age. And more stress is given to the educational component, and it is very well articulated with investments, and a good decision process can be implemented. The first result was the changes to the focus. In 1999, well over half of the children with little height were in the southern part of the country, but most of the support given by Oportunidades, which did not support this, was able to improve all this. These are the ways through which Oportunidades tries to improve the situation. For instance, we're speaking about the care that must be given to both the mother and the child, but also there must be an increase as to the family income, nutritional education, food supplements, health education, and also the support that must be given to health services in order to decrease infections and improve nutrition. We made an evaluation of this program, and it was published in 2004, and we saw that this was really very good. Children grew by 1.1 centimeters, and anemia decreased by 20%. Home improvements were made, more money and a better diet. But the evaluation was also used to find all these mistakes. For instance, we saw that the impact on this program was less than what we expected. What did we see? We saw that iron was reduced, not well absorbed, and fortunately, we have been able to see that now iron sulfate is included because it is better absorbed. We saw that educational talks were inappropriate for the culture of the population, mostly for the Indians, and we had an intervention as to the social marketing that they had to be implemented. We started with pilot projects, and we were able to see this prevalence before and after using fortified foods when they are recommended at the correct time, at the correct age. And this was published in 2007 in order for us to see that this can be bettered. I will skip this. It is not working. Can I have the next one? This happens in Mexico from 1999 to 2006, where poverty has decreased. This is the bottom line. If we make a comparison with the previous period, we saw poverty increased, and these factors could have also affected this. I will skip this one, and I will show you the next one because I just have a little time. Last year, 2 years ago, in 2008, we published an article in the Lancet Journal. This is the Nutrition Lancet series, where we identified a series of investments that have been proven. But the question is, do we use this in terms of efficacy, or actually what do we need to do in order to really use all these policies to anticipate malnutrition? And this is why we have the Mesoamerican system of nutrition. We identified that in order for a specific investment to be efficient, we need to really focus it to the groups that are the ones that need the most and have a good potential answer. Next, we have to intervene in order to attain coverages that will really have an influence on the prevalence. And the last one is all this demand and use the target population will give to it. In this way, we will have effective policies. This can be a checklist in order for us to see what have we done right or wrong. And I am using happy faces or sad faces. And this does reflect how we feel. Well, I think that we have been able to use all these investments that are efficient to focus them appropriately. And we have been able to use Oportunidades, which covers 25 million inhabitants, 5 million households. But the set faces still have to do with the point of delivering appropriate products. So this is one of the problems we have. And mostly, we need to guarantee that the target population is getting all this. We are working with the Oportunidades program in Mexico, and I would like to show this slide in English. I think that this checklist tells us about how can we go from these good interventions to effective interventions. And as a conclusion, well, Mexico had a good performance, an average performance as to chronic malnutrition between 1999 and 2006, while between 1988 and 1999, its performance was poor. Even more, between these years, we tried to benefit the most underprivileged groups. Anemia has decreased slowly but persistently. I did not show this as a public health risk. And of course, this has had a positive impact on all this and social justice, social equity. There are programs and actions that have really proven to be very successful in order to really fight against malnutrition, in order to help the most underprivileged, and to allow the rest of the population to use it. Thank you. The next presentation has to do with a different subject, which is a subject or a tool is developed in order to measure nutrition for a full region, Latin America. Now let's go from this country experience to a tool that can be used by a full continent, and this will be presented by Inés González Casanova. She finished her nutritional degree at the East School, and we were very fortunate of having Inés here at the Institute for 2 years, working in a project of schools in Mexico City to anticipate obesity in school children. And later, with our support, she was admitted in Emory, where she is studying her PhD. She's a PhD student. And, well, it is my pleasure to welcome you, Inés. Thank you very much, Juan. This is a very interesting opportunity to me because, as he said, I was at this institute and it really had a great impact on my training. And this presentation is called How to Develop a Tool to Measure Nutrition Environments in Latin America with Dr. Michael Pratt. Let's go to the background. We have two important types of behavior that really affect the nutritional state. I will speak about obesity and chronic diseases. First of all, we see that people do not eat healthy and they have a very sedentary life. We know that if we have a high consumption of calories and a low energetic expense will be translated into obesity. And, of course, chronic diseases can take place, such as diabetes and osteoporosis, cancer, and CVDs. Why the environment? This is the social ecological model. Eating is a way of seeing this, and this is really affected by several levels. So it is not as if individuals arrived and they act on an independent basis. So we need to analyze the environment in terms of the decisions we make. This is a starting point here at the Institute for me. When I decided to promote physical activities and healthy nutrition, this forms part of my dissertation, the one I presented after my bachelor's degree. And we see that this energy consumption is really triggered by the calories we intake and having a very sedentary life. Well, why do we have to measure these nutritional environments? Well, this statement is taken from a statement at a course I had, and it reads as follows: in order to attain significant progress in this nutritional and fitting environments, we need methods that will be validated. And of course, those of you who have made field work will really become very, very practical. Well, to measure, ideally, includes to check on several sources. We need to define limits or sampling units because we need to see what we are measuring, and we need reliable methods in order to make a good psychometric evaluation. And of course, we need to adapt ourselves. If this becomes very strict, we might neglect some concepts, important ones. Why Latin America? As we have seen, well, Latin America is really having very many changes from a social and demographic standpoint, but also in the fields of nutrition, epidemiology, and demographics. Here we have the Latin American transition, and this includes that obesity has increased, and we can see that in Mexico, Chile, Bolivia, Peru, and different countries, very many of them have a similar pattern, and we speak about a global transition. And we see what happens with malnutrition, obesity, and infectious and chronic diseases. Well, we see that there is a similar context. These are different Latin American cities. This is Sao Paulo, Cartagena, and Mexico City. And this is changing the fitting patterns. And at the same time, we have globalization. We have urban people who are being fed with products that were unavailable at the region. Here we have one other example within the same context. This is the Latin American market, and well, we can see that the access we have to foods is totally different. Here we have Guatemala, Brazil, Colombia, and Peru. And well, this could be any Latin American country. And the tools, in this case, U.S. tools, where a lot of work has been done, are not appropriate to measure Latin American contexts. For instance, We are asked if we promote food at the coffee shop, and my question is which or what coffee shop? And of course, we see here the science coordinator, the principal, the school nurse, the school health coordinator, and we see that this is not suitable for our region, and we also have the Nutrition Environment Measure Survey, and we see that, for instance, the food offer is totally different in some other countries, and some important places we have to measure are not included here. Therefore, it is important to develop tools that will capture the environmental drivers of food. In accordance with Latin America, our objective was to develop a package of tools appropriate for the Latin American context, with the possibility of measuring the characteristics, identify opportunities, and also to evaluate environmental and political interventions that promote healthy nutrition. These are the methods. The first thing we did was to review the literature, and we analyzed three important points that were the environmental drivers at community and environmental factors. We identified methods to measure all this in different places, for instance, a household, school, job site or work site, community and policies, and we identified tools specially designed for Latin America. We also made consultations with experts. We went to the Bill Environment Assessment Training Institute in 2009, where experts in this subject meet, and we were able to consult this with experts at CDC or the Emory University, and we also had different groups working in Latin America. We emailed them, and we had a focal group with professionals of Colombian health officers. We wanted to get in touch with some other groups working in Latin America and have information to contact them, and also methods and tools aimed at protecting the environment. This was a cycle. And finally, we are implementing a pilot test in order to check the protocol. These are the results we have. We identified 40 tools available. Six are adapted to Spanish or Portuguese, four in households. So these are the ones I had access to while I was working here at the Institute. One in a store in Brazil, and another one in a household in the States. Well, very few times these tools are mentioned, and consultations with experts reported that there is a historical impact, for instance, of food help, malnutrition, wrong beliefs, and different media to have access to food. So, taking into account the few tools adapted to the context, which was indeed a surprise because we thought we could find more, we were able to see that we made the decision of developing a protocol describing the process of developing and adapting these tools and to be focused on one environment, which is a nutritional environment we have in schools and the surrounding areas. This is a very good place where to intervene, and this is a controlled environment and known by the researcher. In this case, I was a researcher. This is the tool. It includes eight sections. The first one is the context. Then we measure the availability to food and this is restricted to the policies that affect school. And this is a sample question. Here we see the possibility of having fruits and vegetables, and once this section is filled out, one other table is filled, and we see what type of food can be included here, either healthier or less healthier. The strengths of this study are as follows. We were able to develop a tool that could really fit Latin America. We consider that this really describes the adaptation process. So if you follow the steps, you can really be able to create a tool that will be used in your specific region. And of course, this list is made accordingly to the healthier and less healthier foods, and it has been designed using information on a regional or country basis, and it evaluates the same concepts in different places. One other thing that was done as to the work made had to do with this experience that is also a pilot project in Colombia. The limitations are as follows. The selection of experts was based on academic networks of the researchers. It was biased towards some contexts, such as Brazil, Colombia, and Mexico, due to this same factor. Information is missing as to the Latin American context, and this is why we had to limit ourselves to one single place. In this case, it's the school, and it was very difficult to have access to the tools because since groups have not published anything, do not want to share their tools. Well, important lessons were as follows. Well, we were able to document the adaptation process and the standardization of the measurements made in the United States, but we do not know how this is made. The contextual translation, the versus the literal one, implies that very many times we have a literal translation, and when we arrive at the place where the work is going to be made, we see that it does not apply. However, if what you are translating is the concept, you can measure the same variables appropriately. We have to find channels in order to share information in Latin America that will allow an exchange among different research and community projects. And finally, the school as a sampling unit was very important. This is something we discovered, and it is helping us in the sampling of physical activities because communities gather around schools, and therefore this is a very simple access that will allow us to measure some outside factors, and we are planning on expanding this tool to some other contexts. And well, this is the acknowledgement part to different actors of the Disease Control Center, the Emory University, the FES in Colombia, and the Institute, and mostly to all the researchers who shared their knowledge, expertise, and ideas. Thank you. Thank you very much, Ines. Next presentation, in order to go to the Q&A, will be given by Gloria de Los Angeles. She's a specialist in public health with a master in science and graduate studies in nursing, and she's a researcher of the Autonomous University of Yucatan in Mérida. She is the founder and leader of the Healthy Life Habits as to Physical Activities and Nutrition curriculum. And among her interests, we see nutrition for children under 5 years in urban sites and mostly in socioeconomic factors, mostly those that affect the success of these educational communication programs. So it is my pleasure to welcome Gloria. Well, good afternoon. I thank you all for your participation because you invited us to attend to this Congress and share this. What I'm going to tell you is called Nutritional Evaluation of Children, Caretakers and Professors in a School of Tizimin, Yucatan. These are the participants and members of this research project. As we have already said, well, we really see how this must be done, and we have already spoken of it. So the important thing is as follows. Dr. Juan Rivera said, well, we have really placed this in Mexico, and in the rural part, we see what we are doing in Tizimin, and we also see some obesity problems. In this map, we see all this asterisk where prevalence is present, and we see how we see this present in the school group with the 36.3%. This project actually forms part of the first part of a general project. At a general level, we see that we need to take this into account, and malnutrition has not only to be focused on community efforts, but actually we need to see that if we have chosen this, we need to take into account the participation of several actors. And in this part of the project, we see the nutritional diagnosis from a quantitative standpoint. We have the qualitative part. However, I will focus myself on the quantitative part. In this regard, we decided to measure in children, professors, and caretakers to have a global approach. And sometimes we have just resorted to children, but now we see that children caretakers and professors had to sensitize all this in order to help us see that nutritional problems are not only affecting their children, but also them, and this will affect them. So what we were trying to do was to sensitize this, because nutrition problem is a more general one, instead of thinking that this is just geared to children. In a second stage, together with all these diagnostic results, we tried to put into context educational problems. Therefore, we will have information in order to really create educational programs. They have already been. We have to put them into context in connection with the area of food we have in Yucatan. Next, after doing this, we would implement this, and this would be addressed to caretakers, professors, and children. Next, what we try to do is to evaluate nutritional children's state and evaluate the nutritional program. The general objective was to evaluate the nutritional status of children, caretakers, and professors in a preschool level of TISIM in Yucatan. Specific objectives: to identify social demographic characteristics of families, to determine the nutritional status of preschool children, determine nutritional status of caretakers and professors, so that it will be seen that weight has metabolic implications on their health. The design, as we are focusing them, has to do with the support, and their therefore, it is cross-sectional, and what we do is to really track information, and this was in this preschool level. We had 130 children distributed in five groups, and 107 children participated with their caretakers and professors. Some of them, they did not participate because they were absent when measurements were taken, but we had a participation of 82%. Data gathering. We had informative meetings with professors and caretakers. We made a social demographic survey and anthropometric evaluations, and we detected as well hyperglycemia, cholesterol, and triglycerides, and there was a descriptive statistic. On this chart, what we see here is the civil status, and 85% are married. The school level of caretakers, which was very important because this has to do with children's nutrition, allows us to see that most of them know how to read and write. Only two people didn't, and the majority ranges in people knowing how to read and write, and there are even people, two people, who had a master's degree. Something that caught our eye was the expense these families devote to buying food. 67% earmark 400 to 500 pesos a week for a family formed by four or six members. This is insufficient. Here on this chart, we see the comparison between nutritional status of children, caretakers, and professors. Each column represents 100%, and we see that in preschool children, most of them have a normal nutrition, and just 1% were malnutritioned. We thought that we were going to find a prevalence of 10%, and this has decreased a lot. What we have been able to see is this overweight risk by 11%. And 18%. As to the caretakers, well, the nutritional status is 12%. And from here on, we see overweight or obesity, which virtually surmounts to 88%. As to professors, we see that 7% have the correct nutrition, and 93% they do not have overweight, but they are obese. This is really an alarming figure. As to the frequency of the nutritional status of children by sex, well, we see that this is the overweight girls have, and in one case it is 10%, and for males, 66% have normal nutrition, and 12% there is overweight risk, and 21% overweight. Well, as to average daily consumption of kilocalories by gender, we see that girls exceed what has been recommended, 1,241 kilocalories should be intaken, and they have 1589, and as to children, from 1360 to 1655, over. Here on this chart, we analyzed the waste the waist size. And we see what is normal incremented and substantially incremented. And we see that as to caretakers, only 25% have a normal waistline. From there on, we have 75% that have an increased waistline. And the same thing can be said as to professors, just 2% have a normal waistline, and from there we see 33 and 60% incremented or substantially incremented. As to glycemic levels, both for caretakers and professors, caretakers 94% are normal hyperglycemia and risk of having it 5%. As to professors, we see the blue with normal levels and with yellow hyperglycemia. As to cholesterol levels of caretakers and professors, say here we are aware that caretakers have 76% according to this, and 11% are within limitations, and this without having a reading. When knowing this detection, well, the normal index cannot be read. So this test and detection has to do with the same person in order for us to know whether it was a mistake or not, because the cholesterol index was above. And when it came to professors, 93 have the recommendable cholesterol, and the 55% is within the limitations. And as to triglycerides, caretakers are within what has been recommended, 17% within limitations and 25% high. And once again, we see that this was not read. We weren't able to read it because of some mistakes. As to professors, 40% were within normal limits or what was recommended, and 40% to the other 20% bound to the limitations or higher. Conclusions are as follows. If we analyze the weekly spending is insufficient, taking into account that it's 71 pesos per day for the three meals in a 4 to 5 member family. Prevalence as to overweight and obesity, we see that preschool children were 25% more prone to becoming obese. This was more than what we thought. As to the caloric intake, well, they are having 11% more as to children and 18% as to girls. Overweight and obesity prevalence in caretakers was 87% and 93% in professors. As we have already seen, as to the waistline, we had these caretakers 75%, professors 93%. Glycemia, 6% were hyperglycemic, and professors 7%. Cholesterol, they were within limits, and caretakers present 24% and professors 7%. As to triglycerides, we had very high levels because caretakers presented 50% and professors 60%. In short, our conclusion is school and family environment where children grow in will have an impact on food habits they will have as adults, placing them in a very difficult situation of developing chronic diseases and not a very good life style. They are the ones who are teaching them how to eat. And as to professors, well, they design this school breakfasts, and of course they are really making them intake very many calories. Thank you.
Talk about the use of foods such as plumpy nuts or lipid-based nutritional products. And I'm curious as to what your thoughts are on those, particularly for micronutrient supplementation or lipid-based caloric supplementation. And if you see that as a good idea or perhaps more of a vertical type program or a neo-colonial type program in terms of taking care of malnourished children.
La siguiente pregunta, por favor, vamos a dejar tres preguntas y luego respondemos. Sí.
Yo quisiera saber de la última presentación si tienen pensado o tienen algún dato de comportamiento en el ámbito familiar, así como es la situación familiar respecto a sobrepeso, a los otros indicadores que midieron en los cuidadores y los profesores.
¿Alguna otra pregunta? Yo tengo una pregunta también para la última ponencia, y es, supongo que los cuidadores en general, supongo que eran las madres de familia sobre todo, quería yo preguntarle los datos que nos presenta de sobrepeso, de riesgo de sobrepeso y sobrepeso en niños escolares, qué sistema utilizan. Entonces, vamos a cerrar por el momento estas tres preguntas y tratar de responderla. Sobre la primera pregunta, Richard, would you like to have an opinion about the lipid-based preparations?
Your phones aren't working, so I didn't hear the question in Spanish, but certainly the use of the ready-to-use RUTFs like PumpyNet are proving and emerging to have a major role in acute malnutrition and acute crises. The question is how much micronutrients or other fortificants you might consider adding to them, because I was very impressed by the published results, which I've known about from Dr. Rivera, that if you add micronutrients, it's not just that you decrease the underweight, but you increase height attainment. And that's actually very important, because height attainment is also related to economic productivity. The problems that are emerging with RUTFs and our questions when should you use these plumpy night-like formulas as compared to other interventions? When you use them, it's still not defined how long you have to continue their use. In other words, you're going to stop them abruptly, and then the children will come back 1 or 2 months later. How do you wean people off of them? And as you know, in terms of the lipid content and what type of fats should be included, the Gates Foundation is actually funding a major program now with headed by Kate Huey at U.S. Davis, I guess it is, to really look at what might be the optimal type of lipids. These ready-to-use formulas have high fat content. They need them for the caloric density, but it's still not clear as to what might be the healthiest type of fatty acid to put into these lipids.
Yes, I would like to add to what Richard has mentioned, that I completely agree with Richard's comments. But in general, I would say that the Lancet series that was published in 2008 shows that in areas where there is not a big problem in terms of food security, you, with education, you may be able to really have an impact on growth using the local resources, which is probably the best thing in the long run. However, in areas where there is food insecurity, it is very clear that you need to provide foods that are vehicles of those nutrients that are lacking in that particular situation. So I don't think that a single product will fit all the situations. You really need to identify which are the nutrients that are really missing in the general diet of the population. And for example, in Latin America in general, energy is not a big problem. The problem is really micronutrients, so that you really need to provide some sources, rich sources of micronutrients. So voy a pasarle ahora la palabra a Gloria de Los Ángeles, que tiene dos preguntas.
To Gloria de Los Ángeles, who has two questions to address. As to obesity factors of caretakers, would we have a supplementary information, because we did not focus on adult obesity. We have risk surveys of diabetes mellitus. And this tells us if genetically this is possible. And on the other hand, we have one other nutritional evaluation. For instance, whenever we have CVD, and which are the ones that they have the most, or if they can have foods that will reduce CVD. So these are the two complementary data we have, because actually the purpose was not that of analyzing the history of caretakers. What we can say by and large is as follows. This body mass index, when we made a comparison, is significantly low. However, it is correlated to the fact of having an obese mother or caretaker. Well, thank you very much, Gloria. We're just on time. I have two home announcements to make. First, to ask those of you who have the translation headsets to turn them back. And the second thing is that some forms will be turned in. Please fill them out. I do not know if they are going to be distributed right now, but I was told to make this home announcement. Please fill them out. We sincerely appreciate the speakers and the attendees for this interesting session.